is on the our presentation this morning is on the Upanishads. If any of these topics or any of the discussions appeal to you, and you'd like to help keep the effort alive for the Theosophical movement, please contact anyone of the United Lodges around the world by email, phone, or on site. I'm sure your volunteerism would be very, very welcomed. So let's turn our talk, our minds this morning to a consideration of the Upanishads. We're continuing to review the various expressions of divine wisdom across the ages and around the world since the dawning of mind, Manas, over 18 million years ago. The original impress of this divine wisdom is periodically revealed by thinkers who have earned that duty. They do the best of their ability in the conditions available. The revelation, or reminder, shall we say, left behind by their efforts is then open to continued expressions and interpretations by others. The sects and scriptures that emerge need to be examined with both logic and intuition so that the root of divine wisdom can be rediscovered, preserved, and practiced. We'd like to open this morning's consideration with excerpts from H.P. Blavatsky's The Secret Doctrine. The secret doctrine is the common property of the countless of millions of humans born under various climates, in times with which history refuses to deal, and to which esoteric teachings assign dates incompatible with the theories of geology and anthropology. The birth and evolution of the sacred science of the past are lost in the very night of time. It is only by bringing before the reader, in an abundance of proofs, all tending to show that in every age, under every condition of civilization and knowledge, the educated classes of every nation made themselves the more or less faithful echoes of one identical system and its fundamental traditions. That he can be made to see that so many streams of the same water must have had a common source from which they started. What was this source? If coming events are said to cast their shadows before, past events cannot fail to leave their impress behind them. It is then by those shadows of the hoary past and their fantastic silhouettes on the external screen of every religion and philosophy that we can, by checking them as we go along and comparing them, trace out finally the body that produced them. There must be truth and fact in that which every people of antiquity accepted and made the foundation of its religions and its faith. The study of the hidden meaning in every religious and profane legend of whatsoever nation, large or small, preeminently the traditions of the East, has occupied the greater portion of the present writer's life. She, HPB, is one of those who feel convinced that no mythological story, no traditional event in the folklore of a people has ever been, at any time, pure fiction, but that every one of such narratives has an actual historical lining to it. So this morning, let us turn our minds to a consideration of the Upanishads, the sacred scripture of the Indian subcontinent. This talk is a mere overview, a signpost for the future path of individual study. HPB wrote that the Upanishads are to the Vedas what the Kabbalah is to the Old Testament. It is the ancient written source of esoteric knowledge, reflecting untold generations of oral traditions from teachers to students. As such, it predates both the Buddhistic and the Hindu Vedic teachings. The Upanishads are written in the universal language of the soul, using symbols to express the true nature of man, the true nature of the universe, the cycles of reincarnation, and the fraternity, the oneness of perfected souls leading all others. There are multiple anonymous recorders of these sacred scriptures. In the Theosophical Glossary is the statement that the Upanishads is an esoteric doctrine that destroys ignorance and produces liberation, and that it is an echo of primeval wisdom religion that would eventually lead to the Vedanta. It did not support the development of the Brahmanic class, monopolizing wisdom and thus power. In fact, the Kshatriya, the warrior, is the caste that produces the kingly who will lead others to salvation. Among their number would be found instructors called King Hierophants, the Dhyani Buddhas, Kumaras, elsewhere. The Upanishads reflect wisdom from a period when there was one language or symbology, one religion, and one science on the globe. For many in the modern era, a study of the Upanishads deals with recommended practices for the art and science of living. Rituals, benedictions, ceremonies, sacrifices, meditation, ethics. For those many, they're probably looking at the literal written word using logic more than any other powers. Frequently, the format of the scriptures features a dialogue between a teacher and a disciple, and that will feel very familiar to those of us that have been studying the Key to the Theosophy this winter, that dialogue between theosophist and inquirer. It will also seem very familiar to those of us who have many years been studying the Gita with the dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna. This format of the dialogue is a struggle for the disciple to understand the cosmic and the personal, the meaning of life. Those dialogues should be revisited in the light of esoteric keys. So the true student of theosophy would come to these dialogues in the Upanishads looking for the meaning between the lines, looking for the meaning in the words, in the similes, in the analogies, and therefore finding those in the heart of heart would use keys to interpret the meaning of the Upanishads. There are 108 of these Upanishads that are known. They were originally memorized as oral traditions, and the written recording of these by anonymous recorders began prior to the reform efforts of the Buddha. Some are very ancient, and others were recorded between the first millennium BCE and even as late as the 15th century of the Common Era. Some were most accepted in Northern Asia. Others were most accepted in Southern Asia. From the earliest of the Upanishads, the Vedic literature has emerged. For many modern students of theosophy, the Gita and the Puranas might be the most recognizable as reflections of the early Upanishads. Two general worldviews are possible interpretations of these original scriptures. A monistic view that all emanates from one reality is frequently a theme. A dualistic view that all emanations coming from that one reality can be seen in spirit and matter. And that one is probably most present in the Hindu echo of the Upanishads. But as students of theosophy, we see a pattern, a teaching of an original source of deific wisdom that gradually emerges in various interpretations, each needing study and the use of keys to find the root understandings within the modern expressions. The basic motif in this sacred scripture, or body of sacred scriptures, is the quest for realizing the ultimate reality of the universe and of man. Brahman is the term used for expressing that unknowable, infinite absolute so familiar to the students of theosophy. The Atman is the term used to express the radiation or reflection of that within the deepest self of the human state. An understanding of these principles is to be achieved through direct experience of insight, meditation, and intuition. It is not to be achieved through philosophical speculation, rational logic alone. The modern student of theosophy might be reminded of the differences between the heart and the eye doctrines of perception and creation possible in the human state. Having said that, whatever the approach, reasonable, reasoned faith, intuitive insight, whichever, the teaching of the absolute surfaces again to be universal in this sacred scripture. From the pages of the Upanishads come some familiar anchor statements that students of theosophy sometimes use in establishing their periods of meditation. Frequently, these are fondly called shaving practices, but the phrases date back to the Upanishads. Not this, not that. As a seed thought, that thou art, as another seed thought. These phrases are echoed throughout the West today, in part because of the tremendous work done by Blavatsky, Judge, and others in the 19th century. But that echo of the Upanishads is also universal in other sacred scripture. Attributed to the Christ figure in John 10:30 is the phrase, "I and my Father art one." In Corinthians 3:16 to 23 is the phrase, "Christ in you, the hope of glory." In the modern language pattern, we have the phrase namaste. Blavatsky expressed the concept of this beingness and the causeless cause which produces the sacred within the soul that is using the human state throughout the secret doctrine. But certainly, volume one. Page 280 is a great reference for her echo of this ancient teaching. This spiritual view of universality was noted by Schopenhauer when he studied the Upanishads. Metaphysics and meditation superseded rituals for anthropomorphic gods. The nature of individualized consciousness was key. Consciousness was said to be unfettered by the material world and the senses when endeavor is produced in the human state. The Atman was said to be the reincarnating self. Karma was understood to be true. Modern students of theosophy experience a reflection of the Upanishads as they study the pages of the very practical Bhagavad Gita. The principles are one and the same. Yogic meditation supersedes temple worship. Self-realization is the dharma of soul using the human state. Knowing the self is to know the glory of the divine. The dialogue between Krishna and the warrior Arjuna is the traditional format passed down from the Upanishads. And both Einstein and Oppenheimer found a study of this system to be gratifying. So this is not just the art of living, but it is also a reflection of the science of living. Historical traces of the teachings of the Upanishads are readily available. In the writings of Pythagoras and Plato, similar statements can be found about the source of knowledge, justice, and a path to salvation. The cave allegory of Plato is very similar to one found in the Upanishads. Both Western thought leaders, Pythagoras and Plato, were known to have traveled through the Middle East and in India, Persia. Blavatsky is not alone in writing about the Upanishads in the 19th century of the Common Era. Schopenhauer certainly did. The transcendentalists, Emerson and Thoreau among them, also did. The quantum physicist, the founder of quantum physics, Schrödinger, was born in 1887, but he developed his ideas in science while reading these ancient texts in the 20th century. For your study, there are many, many sources. There's a series of articles in the Theosophical Movement magazine published by students of theosophy in India that are most useful in the study of the Upanishads. There is Judge's Echoes of the Orient that you could use. There are a series of articles of India being the mother lode of ancient scriptures in the bound volume of the Ancient Landmark series. And if you want to use the research center at Theosophy Hall, you could look into any of that and all of that. But one series was used in particular for preparing this morning's talk. And that series of articles is entitled Symbolism of the Upanishads, is in Theosophical Movement, Volume 31, begins on page 264, but there are three different articles. It is actually a reprint of the original set of articles published in the Path magazine in March 1894. These particular articles stress that certain keys are needed to understand these sacred texts. The ultimate comprehension and application of the Upanishads can be fully understood by the loftiest of sages. But they benefit all souls endeavoring to understand. The Katha Upanishad is used in this series of articles. There is a term, Nachiketas, as the symbol of the soul. And please excuse any mispronunciations that you're hearing. There is a dialogue in the Katha that is between a father who represents past births and a son who represents the new incarnation of the eternal soul. The house of death spoken of represents two things: the physical world of illusion, the house of death that we walk through as Maya or illusion, as well as the underworld experience of an initiation process that's available to each reincarnating soul. The Katha speaks of a triple fire, very familiar in meaning to the student of theosophy: the trinity of Atma, Buddhi, and Manas. There is an altar of sacrifice spoken of, and that altar is described as being square, a quaternary. It is an exemplar of the manifested physical world. The student of theosophy immediately sees the concept of sevenfold being, sevenfold essence, sevenfold principles, sevenfold aspects, an eternal upper triad, and a transitory lower or personal quaternary. There's another symbol used in the opening of the Katha, and that is a descriptor of 3 days of death and resurrection. Very common in the Western world at this time of year. But the descriptor in the Katha Upanishad is a descriptor of an initiation rite not unique to the appearance of that descriptor in the New Testament accounts of the Christ. A second portion of the Katha treats the need for practice to eliminate the lower self, to control it, to hamper it, to extinguish the reliance on sensual experience and the driving force of the lowest passions and desires. Each soul is instructed to choose between the better course of action and the dearer, the goal being to open the doors of the great beyond. Man, it is taught, as a duality, can never achieve satisfaction through the pursuit of lower desires and passions. Rather, the choice to pursue the dearer experience, the personal experience, the terrestrial experience, that becomes a vicious cycle of cause and effect. And any addict can testify to just a taste of a particular addictive substance or experience triggers a cycle again. So, again, in this ancient text, that's the conversation: how to be as a ray of the deific, how to act from that eternal premise, and how to gradually self-evolve the principles necessary to fulfill Dharma. The Katha teaches that there are three worlds to be conquered by soul: mind, emotion, and action. The key is to purify, to elevate the use of desire. Desire first arose in it, It is a force. It has no color. It is colored by the efforts of soul. A student of theosophy is reminded of the concept that the voice of the silence has its source in the higher self, a radiant of the absolute. Peace can only be achieved from kindling the triple fire of being, Atma, bliss, buddhi, and knowledge, manas. The fruit of good works, we read in the voice of the silence, is service to others, to all others. And that service is said to be devakan. That roots directly back to the Katha Upanishad. Having said all that, the Katha teaches that the higher self is truly free from the pairs of opposites and the gunas. It is far above them and changeless, unaffected by the righteousness of ritual law or the breach of ritual law. That higher self is the knower, the ordainer, a facet of the infinite one. That higher self is of the nature of will and power. The Katha teaches, therefore, that full detachment from terrestrial life is possible, is very possible in the evolution of the path of soul. The final portion of the Katha Upanishad instructs one to realize the one truth in the inmost recesses of the heart. The Katha, therefore, taught about this impress of spiritual knowledge within. And this is a quote from that translation. Those who know the eternal, the five fires and the triple flame tell of shadow and light entering the cave through the long ago and drinking the rewards of good deeds in the world. Let me read that again. It's going to sound familiar. Those who know the eternal, the five fires and the triple flame tell of shadow and light entering the cave through the long ago and drinking the rewards of good deeds in the world. So, what do we sense in the symbology there? The five fires are the five senses, or the five powers of the senses, the source of experience, the tools with which to encounter the phenomenal, illusionary world. This mastery is to be accomplished through the union with the triple flame, the lighting up of the human soul, the flame of spirit, soul, and pure reason, pure mind. The outer world is the field of life and the possibility of building a bridge or a link between the lower and the higher self. Creating this inner link or bridge through introspection or an examined life, through a meditative stance, a practice of meditation, uses similes like those found in the Bhagavad Gita and the Voice of the Silence. Buddhi manas can govern kama, desire, through the use of manas under the inspiration of Atma. Atma is the self. It is the lord of the chariot of the warrior. Sharira is the body, the chariot itself. Buddhi is the soul, the charioteer. Manas is mind, and the reins are held and used by the soul or the charioteer. The horses are symbolic of the organs and the impulses of the physical astral body. The road traveled is the phenomenal external world to be used. To be used as we create that inner eternal spiritual path to full oneness and full expression of spiritual soul in the human state. In the Katha, there is strong warning that the unwise or unmindful exhibit manas not dominated, not in the least lit by Buddha. Those that self-evolve are said to create shraddha, the union with those who have gone before. Esoteric oneness with the ascending guru parampara chait, esoteric oneness with the ancient sages that have rediscovered, preserved, and promulgated the sacred scripture, like the Katha Upanishad, like all the others from around the world. That self-evolution is very, very possible. The annual rituals expressed in the Katha Upanishad and throughout much of the Vedic body of wisdom celebrate family ties with ancestors. Their annual rites and rituals in temple and in society throughout the Vedic world that celebrate family ties. But it is in the Katha Upanishad that we find the wisdom that that outer expression, however comforting, is merely the lowest expression of the inner truth. That as we endeavor to practice the balance of yoga, of meditation, of right living and right speech and right thought, right action, as we endeavor to produce that, we are actually communing with this guru parampara chain that has left behind these tremendous exemplars of ancient wisdom. The Katha Upanishad ends with these words: "This is the immemorial teaching declared by death to Nachiketas," death again being that spiritual initiation of that inner revolution, Nachiketas, the soul. Declaring and hearing it, the wise grows great in the world of the eternal. He who causes this supreme secret to be heard in the assembly of those who seek the eternal, or at the time of the union with those who have gone forth, builds for everlastingness. He builds for everlastingness. There's the true meaning behind our colloquial words, go with God. In the comparative study of these sacred scriptures, in the effort to rediscover them, preserve them, and share them, we build bridges with a guru parampara chain that is far beyond our finite mind's power to envision. And we offer the ultimate service and sacrifice to all souls, in all places, in all times. This is the true meaning with the colloquial words, go with God. Look within, thou art that. So that's a simple little guideline to merely one of these 108 Upanishads that can be read and studied. And again, we're invited to not read them literally, but to read them, ponder them, and try to look into the symbology and look into the similes and the allegories and the correspondences to find signposts on our own paths through life. I'm sure that you came this morning with considerations of sacred scriptures in your mind. SL?
On Friday evening, we had a round table on an article called The Vow of Silence. And one of the principles suggested there was to not ask questions frivolously or uselessly, but to consider it thoroughly with all your powers of understanding before. And the author mentions that in ancient times, the guru would give the student seed ideas on which to think and meditate. And these had a cleansing, uplifting effect on the mind and the principles. So we wonder when we read these Upanishads, perhaps the idea is to take one idea out of the 108 verses that really strikes us and to use it as a seed idea. To think about on a daily basis or for a few days to really try to think it and understand it, and maybe then ask questions. So these questions and answers are not like a ongoing classroom experience. They are assuming that the student who's asking the question has thought about the previous instruction, and now their questions relate to that personal meditation and exploration. So in that way, they become very much alive and practical to us today.
Alive and practical is the key. And while the comment was being made, what popped into this mind is the ancient mystery schools that Pythagoras established that involved a statement by the teacher to the students, but there were 7 years of silence, wasn't there? There were 7 years in which the students did not speak in the presence of their teacher, but rather took in the seed ideas and then pondered them in the inmost chamber of their heart, merging their mind, probably in accord with Patanjali's yoga aphorisms of how to focus and consider, and then to turn those ideas over and over and over again. And the fact that so much of the katha was involved with look within, consider privately, research by intellect and intuition, begin to test out the seed idea in our outer lives. And we can only imagine that in this ancient system, in the mystery schools and a monastic kind of setting, what happens is that old phrase, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. So as the student ponders the seed idea, assimilates the essence of it, tests out the reality of the ethics of it, serves others with the seed idea, the teacher appears and more enlightenment is gained, more explanation, more information will come. How many of us have said in our lives, oh, the universe is speaking. I have XYZ of a problem or a consideration in life. And no matter where I turned this day or this week, there was something on the radio, something on the TV, something occurred in a discussion with a stranger. I accidentally found a magazine article, all moving to clarify the issue. The teacher is speaking. SL first and then MDW.
Yes, I'll take that second SL. No,
SL
seriously.
squared.
Seriously. You mentioned earlier on that the Upanishads, if we look at Hinduism and Buddhism as a reflection of them have a northern and southern teaching. And my first inclination was to wonder if the northern teaching isn't closest to the Himalayan school and the Tibetan, such that it dogmatizes to a degree to the southern in both Buddhism and Hinduism. And then secondly, the dialectic notion of the bird on one branch questioning or being below the bird on the upper branch, bodhicitta, if that isn't the natural perspective taken within the Upanishad, such as in the Gita, between Arjuna and Krishna, replicating the natural relationship of ourselves to ourself, in which case the self is the friend and the enemy of self, interestingly enough. So I
And
present.
we are to raise the self with lowercase by the self with the capital S. So yes, the whole teaching that was found in at least the Katha was that we do raise, there's several different ways to find this symbolism and to work with it. One of them is we have the interior dialogue between our higher degree of consciousness and our personal degree of consciousness. That dialogue goes on as we endeavor to find right living and to serve and express that. But aren't we told, as that higher self is a radiant reflection, emanation of the oneness of this absolute from which we all spring? From the spiritual reflection of that, the minute we begin that process of internal dialogue, we're reflecting the Arjuna to the Krishna. We're reflecting the eternal spreading light, clarifying for the temporary. And in that moment, the namaste is timeless, it is an enduring presence from before 18 million years ago to the present moment, one moment at a time. MDW.
You mentioned that there's many different Upanishads. My question is the Bhagavad Gita part of the Upanishads?
It is a later or parallel expression of it, so that if the Gita is over 5,000 years old, these earliest Upanishads are far before the Gita. And the Gita is an effort in order to express aspects of the same sacred scripture as the Upanishad. So for some students, we would say, you know what, you're splitting hairs. If there is this eternal divine truth embedded in these early Upanishads, and we find a remarkable reflection and expression in the Gita, in the voice, around the world in various other cultures, then they're one and the same. There are latter day Upanishads as well, which would then be other interpretations. There's no mystery about why one of the three original objects for the TS was to really do some comparative study of ancient and modern science, religion, and philosophy. It continues to brew down in essence as we peel everything, skim away all the external rituals and particularization. We find that inner core over and over again. SL number one.
Yes, regarding the previous question about this northern and southern interpretations of the Upanishads. So, for those interested in the Secret Doctrine, Volume 1, page 270, 271, HPB relates the ancient tradition understanding that at one point the Upanishads were attached to the Vedas and they were jealously guarded by the Hindu priests, the Brahmins, for purposes of initiation. But Buddha, learning of these and wanting to make them more available to the people, began to teach them, especially in the northern sections of India, and then moving into China and Asia, northern areas of Asia, so that these original Upanishads were changed and altered by the Brahmins, so that they could refute Buddhist teachings and say, well, you see, that's not in the Upanishads. And she goes on to say that Sankaracharya and his sect are the only ones in southern India that actually preserve the original understanding of the Upanishads as taught by Buddha in the north. Otherwise, the southern schools are more influenced by the later changes that were made in the Upanishads. So we think that's important when you're reading the Upanishads to try to search for the symbolism behind the words and to use other keys given to us to see their real meaning.
Could you repeat your citation for that?
Yes, that's the secret doctrine. It's all part of that summing up section
Yes.
of Secret Doctrine, Volume 1, specifically pages 270, 271.
Very important to understand that, and we can see a prime example of the split between the North and the South in that the degree of ritualization and the masks of the anthropomorphic external gods as symbols have morphed into religious practices of the Southern Asian affect of Buddhism, for example, whereas you can find the original in the Mahayana Northern schools, and again, they're all subject to expressions and understandings, and the conditions available and the language available. So again, we search with our hearts, we use logic, but the intuition will be there. And we think of this entire Guru Parampara line, frankly, as a group of reformers. If you look at this from the viewpoint of the Buddha, if you look at this from the viewpoint of Sankaracharya, you can do that history. If you look at this from the viewpoint of Blavatsky and Judge, these are all souls who have come forth under duty, able to express and correct and to clarify and turn latter-day souls back to an original course of contemplation, an original root source, if you will, of divine wisdom. And again, this the whole issue with the Brahmin caste holding the true essence, esoteric or hidden from the people, that runs parallel in the Western world with the rise of Christian cults and sects. But again, students of theosophy are invited not to belong to any cult or sect, but to belong to each and all. Study them, line them up, see where the parallels exist, and attempt to envision what the true, not external revelation, but what the true impress revelation from within can be. Theosophy Hall, and then the second SL.
Yes. So the Bhagavad Gita was given to the world in 5,000 years ago at the beginning of the Kali Yuga, our present Dark Age. So the Upanishads, at least the beginning of the Upanishads, were given out during the Golden Age
Yes.
because it was a golden age. And so these instructions are specifically for the spiritually dark ages that we're in. So they're very practical, and it's a way to hold on tight, as it were, during this relatively short period of time, which is still hundreds of thousands of years. So
So there's only the moment, right? There's only the now. So
Right.
if we worry about the past, we're probably going to get depressed. If we are incredibly attached to the turmoil that we're sensing right now, those five senses that were alluded to in the Katha, we're probably going to become pretty stressed out. If we're projecting into the future, anxiety might be ensued. But instead, if we stay in the now, if we try to maintain the point of view of I am that, as the Upanishads teach, I am that. There's an eternity, and I am experiencing, I am observing, but I am not in it. I'm above it as soul, capable of helping others to achieve a degree of peace amid great turmoil. And oh boy, the Kali Yuga is still unfolding. Stephen Levy.
Unmute, Steve.
He's working on it.
Yeah, you can't read what I'm saying unless I say it. So much for lip reading. No, the previous question leads into mine to a degree because I was thinking that one of the great directions we've been given from the in the Great Master's letter, etc., is that theosophy in relation to the common man. And it seems to me the common man is most under the hand of common religion, which at least it seems to me, as you were describing the Upanishadic method from teacher to student, that that's broken within common religion, because the connection between how we should see the teachers seems to be overlaid by, I guess I should call it churchianity. So it makes me wonder if our responsibility isn't somehow to reinstill that notion of the lower self to the higher self, this relationship within us, as well as in the Guru Parampara.
So, as we endeavor to move through life and we see before us the power play that's going on with teachings like an anthropomorphic god, the power and control of a priestly caste, however it plays out, the struggle between political and military figures versus self-acclaimed religious outer expressions. As we watch all that going on, we're seeing, aren't we, a reflection of the internal struggle of the Kshatriya caste. Arjuna, we are part of the Kshatriya caste. We are in the struggle, in the war internally to clarify the lower, to raise it and elevate it to the higher as best we can. And that is a struggle. It's ongoing. It's in us, it's around us. We can see examples of it in the outer world. But as we work on it from within and we put ourselves through these periods of silence, contemplation, imagination, willful endurance, and then we use that force and that energy to color the day for our fellow humans. We can uplift all. We can neutralize some of what's going on and perhaps maintain a little bit of a sense of humor that this struggle is eternal, it's ongoing, it's a natural cycle, and this too shall pass. Just as this meeting has now passed, we're past time. So please, please remember that Wednesday night is the next session. Friday night is another session, but you have the right and the privilege to contact ULT Philadelphia if you need a study center during the course of this week. Bye bye, and thank you for this morning.
Thank you. Bye-bye.